OTB's Mount Rushmore. 32 counties. One county representative choosing their sporting Mount Rushmore. Some decisions are easy.
And I was seeing teachers who had never expressed any emotion whatsoever lose their mind when Sonny was running in that home straight, trying to catch that gold spot.
Others are controversial.
Mayo's greatest celebrity fan now helps him earn his place on Mayo's Mount Rushmore is Kevin Kilbane.
Join the debate across all our social channels at Off the Ball.
George O'Connor, 17 summers in purple and gold.
And catch the live decision-making over the next few months on OTB AM, live every weekday at 7.30 a.m. on OTB Sports Radio. The OTB Podcast Network.
Monday Night Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us, everyone in.
Now, on Monday Night Rugby this evening, we are reuniting two former teammates. We've done a few of these of late on the show. Ronan O'Gara partnered up with Peter Stringer. On another evening, we had Rog with David Humphreys talking about their rivalry. We put Ronan with Brian O'Driscoll together a few weeks back. That was a really interesting chat. Tonight, we are welcoming Brian back again. Hello.
Hi there.
And with him, some long overdue credit to our guest. They say he showed young Brian everything he knows about midfield play. Former Irish international, Munster player, 2001 British and Irish Lion as well. Rob Henderson, hello to you.
Evening all.
He showed me a hell of a lot more than centre play, that, let me tell you.
It had nothing to do with centre play.
You two are firm friends, got on very well from the off, I suspect. Rob, do you keep in touch much?
Not as much as we could have done. Obviously, Brian being an international superstar, doesn't really have time for the little people anymore. It's very difficult for him to get out of that vault of cash that he has stashed away, which is doing him well, actually. It's keeping him warm in these COVID times. But no, as and when we can, it's normally at events and charity things now.
The little people, that's why we've been in contact so much.
Now, you see, he's not only got this thing about this the hierarchy, but he's also fattest. I'm not happy about that.
Well, I might jump in at a point and you can take me where you want to take me here. So, Rob, I saw a quote from you, and if we're picking up your partnership and where you two kind of started playing together, you had a quote where you said, "My highest and lowest moments in rugby started with phone calls from Donal Lenehan." So let's jump in at the low point and then we'll get to the high point. The low point being the 99 World Cup, I presume, when you're what? You're 26, 27 years old?
Yeah, I was 26. Looked a lot younger, very fit, obviously, having just come out of the amateur era, which I think is what Rico was alluding to about things that I may have taught him when he's just entering the scene. And obviously, you've... Brian was obviously involved in both of those tours. I get a phone call in 99, having played reasonably well in the 99 Six Nations. Didn't get selected, and it was Don Lennon Mannix that rang me and gave me that bad news, unfortunately. So I did what most players do. I went on the last for 3 months and then decided I can either be an average player or test myself. So I tested myself, and a couple of years later, he gave me the phone call to say I'd made it on the Lions tour.
So that was the big wake-up call for you, was it?
Well, it was one of them. It was one of them, having played 5 years as an amateur at London Irish, with everything that amateur rugby, London Irish, and the bright light of London goes for it, that I had to do something. But yeah, it was a kick up the hole that I think I needed at the time. Obviously, desperately disappointed, because Brian had just come onto the scene, was... Obviously, you want to test yourself with and against the best, and even at that age, you know when you've got quality in class. And I know that Brian doesn't need me to blow smoke up his rear end, because he was he's a top man. B, he was an unbelievable player, even at that early age, and his career is testament to that. So missing out on playing with good players, going to a World Cup, those things are disappointing. But I think the following few years more than made up for it.
Hendo, on the transition from that amateur era into professionalism, how long do you think it took for the penny to fully drop for you to understand what was expected of you from a professional point of view? Because certainly from my point of view, I came out of school and went straight into being a professional, but it still took a long time. I can't imagine how hard it must have been to be working and playing, you know, competitive rugby and then playing international rugby and then all of a sudden be paid, and but to change your psyche?
Well, it's something that I remember I was at London Irish at the time, and Sir Clive was our coach back in the day. And I remember when he actually rang me up, I'd been working for 4 years at this stage, and he rang me up and said, I'd like to make you our first professional signed player at London Irish. And I think before he got the R of Irish out, I'd said yes. So, what you mean, you're actually going to pay me to do this at the weekend? But that whole transition of going to work every day and then training you two nights a week or three nights a week if you did a little bit extra, and then being full-time into it, I'd suggest it took, I don't know, 2 years, maybe 3 years even, because it went pro in around 95, 96. And trying to get your head around, this isn't an excuse for you to be with your buddies all the time and just and go for an afternoon session. No, that's not what it's about. It's about being the best player you can be and about coordinating your team and then going on from there. So it did take quite some time, to be honest with you.
Rob, was Donal Lennon or whoever gave you the message explicit in that it was maybe down to your fitness and you could be working harder and doing more, or was it just a brief enough, listen, not this time around, Rob, goodbye?
Yeah, no, I mean, to be fair, he had fair reasoning, because I was man of the match twice in the Six Nations that year, and they took Matt Mostyn from Connacht. So it was a fair call. Stop laughing, Rico.
The truck, I haven't heard about the truck in a while.
There you go now. So now it's just one of those decisions. And funnily enough, I'm good friends with Phil Danaher, and I see him regularly. And for the last, I don't know, 20 years, he's always said, Hendo, I voted for you. And there was only three in the panel. So if Donald told me he voted for me, Danza told me he voted for me.
Had three votes. That was
that was the issue. So, no, it wasn't that. It was just tough calls that need to be made. And, and you take it on the chin and get on with it.
Am I right in saying you found your fitness trainer in the Yellow Pages?
Correct. Yep. Yeah, I obviously having missed out, and after my 3 month sabbatical, having a few beers and watching the lads obviously do so well in that 99 World Cup. I went to the...
Are you wearing your Argentina jersey by chance?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. No, if there's one thing I am, I'm definitely not bitter, but I'm fully supporting the lads. But I wanted to get fit, and I didn't know how to do it, so I just picked up the Yellow Pages. I found a guy called Warren Lachlan in the book. I rang him up, and I took it from there. So I trained with him 6 days a week, trained with the club twice a day, and then trained on my own in the evening. So four times a day, 6 days a week, really.
Wow.
Which is better than the cycling I was telling you about earlier, because I did actually manage to lose a few pounds doing that. I mean, your training regime, Drico, when you were coming out of school and college, you guys must have been at it almost like pros when you were there anyway, and then you come back into the professional. There can't have been that much of a difference.
No, there wasn't really. Like, we were, like, school training was incredible in Blackrock College. Like, the fitness levels, the fitness work we would have done would have matched any professional team at that time. There was a real focus on us being the fittest team in Leinster Schools rugby. And I think back to some of those grueling sessions, and as a professional, I really would have struggled with some of them. Such was the kind of physical nature of them, and just huge aerobic capacity necessitated. But we did that, and then straight into the Irish Foundation, as it was. The academy was known as the Foundation then, and that was a national thing rather than a provincial thing. And then I was also with the UCD, in the UCD Foundation too, where I got a scholarship. So yeah, we were kind of being treated as professionals, but yet the mindset, I think it's those that you hang around with. You know, when you hang out with people that have been amateurs and had, you know, played in the amateur era, you adapt their, you know, or you adopt their mindset. And there was probably a bigger drinking culture than there should have been in those early years, and it took a while for us to really know when to leave it off. But we had some bloody good times though as well. I look back, and sometimes those are the really great times that you remember. We mightn't have won as many games as perhaps we should have, but it felt as though we'd such a good balance of being of playing some good rugby, but also having a great time together, huge camaraderie, great fun together. Look back and think of them as the real standout night and celebrations. Even though we didn't always win games, we still celebrated, you know, playing test matches and the black tie events in the Berkeley court, where you'd be mixing with the opposition. Whereas nowadays, or certainly towards the end of my career, it was a bit, it just became a bit clinical. It became a bit next game focused rather than enjoying that moment. And now you meet up with, you know, those players that you played with 20 years ago, and it's, it, you kind of pick up like a friend that you haven't spoken to for ages. You just pick up where you left off.
Yeah. I'm not saying that we were a little bit behind, but, with that professionalism, but I remember staying in the Barclay Court, and the Friday night before matches, Axel, God rest his soul, used to ring the pizza in. So we'd have about 18 pizzas on the Friday night before a match, just to make sure we're fully carbo loaded for the following day at 3 o'clock.
You know why that got outlawed by Eddie O'Sullivan in the end? It was nothing to do with the nutrition. He was just afraid that we were all going to get food poisoning collectively one time. So he said, I can't have that. He said, you can go and have in-house pizzas here. And that was, by the way, that was washed down with a good half litre of Coke as well. Make sure that if you had any insomnia, it had to wait until 3 in the morning. No wonder we ran out onto the pitch exhausted at times the next day, having had three. But it's mad when you think back, that was just the norm. And sometimes, until that habit is broken, do you not realize how crazy those things were? I even think back to the 2001 Lions tour, where on the Tuesday night we played there was a midweek game, can't remember, against New South Wales Country. And I think you were out with me, where we went out and I think I had 7 or 8 bottles of beer on a Tuesday night. Day off Wednesday, train Thursday, captain's run Friday, play the test match on Saturday. And didn't bat an eyelid. Whereas now, imagine 7 or 8 bottles of beer. But that's crazy.
That's always the professionalism of you, though, Dricko, because you had 7 or 8 bottles, and me and the other lads were langers. We couldn't even walk.
Still play great on a Saturday afternoon, though.
Rob, give us your memories then. The two kind of things that jumped out to me that we'd ask you about would have been obviously the Lions in 01, which we'll come to, but then Paris in 2000. Give us your standout memories from this remove, or the thing that stays with you the most. Let's start with the match first as opposed to the night.
What do I remember most about it? I remember most that 2 years previously we could have won, and we mucked it up, and I think we lost 19-15. The following year we lost 10-9 at Lansdowne Road, so it was coming. But obviously in 2000, we had a certain up-and-coming superstar with us. And we just had a bit more belief. We had a bit more belief in it about what we were doing. Warren and Gatland, like him, love him, loathe him, whatever. I think he was quite fundamental at the start point of getting Irish rugby to the momentum and going in the right direction where it is today. I mean, in 98, he'd put an advert in the press for people to send in well wishes to the hotel. So there was wall to wall, and we just read that. That was our team talks. So that was the start of it. The following year, we probably should have won in Lansdowne Road. And then in 2000, obviously with a younger squad of excellent young players coming through and a bit more self-belief, we went over and thinking that we could compete with these people. And I was just saying, Dricko, that the one thing that stood out for me in that game was Dennis Hickey.
Oh, yeah, what a tackle that was.
Oh, my God.
He played brilliant, full stop. I watched watched the game, a bit of the game. They showed it back on Off the Ball there a while ago, and they were talking about it. And so I watched the first 5 minutes. His first touch was not magnificent. Do you remember his left foot used to be a rocket launcher, or it could be a sand wedge shank, you know?
Yeah.
It was going to be one of the two. So he got a ball within 30 seconds and he absolutely hoofed it into row Z with his first touch. So I immediately got on the text to him to abuse him about the sand wedge being out. But after that, he was unreal. That tackle on Dalmazzo will go down as one of the
So, I mean, he hacks it back 40 yards. Dalmazzo scores that. With the greatest respect, I think we lose the game.
Yeah.
game over. And actually, that was probably the first, that was the first of your tries, because you dotted it down when he knocked it forward.
When?
When Del Mazo knocks it forward after Dennis had tackled him, yeah. You're actually the one that dots it down for the 22. Oh,
that's right. Yeah. I was the old. I've held it up, but he brought it over. Yeah. I don't know.
So technically, you got four that day. But and then obviously everyone played magnificently well. Mallow Kelly with a left hand miss pass. Oh, I mean, technically, I reckon that he was trying to throw a dummy. But just let the ball go. But coming out, and Brian will tell you that there was a pocket of Irish fans up in one of the corners, and with 65 minutes to go, started out singing the 75,000-80,000 French that were in there, and it just gave us an extra lift. And being able to walk off that field, having beaten them for the first time since 1972 in Stade Colombe, having never won in Parc des Princes, was just so emotional. And the evening that then ensued was as Olympic.
Yeah, we've heard. You made 24 tackles that day, by the way.
25, because I tackled a massive fry in the morning.
What about the do you know what I was looking as well, is that the second try that I got was like just picking up a lazy line on that on your offload, right? Mm. But if you look at it, you had so much work to do to get it away, because Raj committed absolutely no one. He literally started running across the pitch and threw the ball to you without committing one defender. And then those snake hips came in that you probably weren't renowned for. And then what a beautiful ball back inside. Beautiful timing for my little lazy run. But it's hilarious. I know the game has moved on massively, but... you think back, it felt like a super tough test match, but then 20 years later, you know, it's hard to talk to, you know, the upcoming players and say that was at the time felt like really hard physical test match rugby, even though it looked defensively a little bit soft.
Well, it's, I mean, you can look at a game from 10 years ago. I mean, the games have moved on massively from 60, 70, 80, 90, 2000, whatever way you want to look at it. I mean, I just know for a fact that there were no seagulls over that stadium that day, because I was sucking every single one of them. It was warm, it was hot, it was and when you defend, it's harder to defend than it is to attack, because you're just getting battered and battered and battered and battered, and then when you do get the ball, you don't have the energy to go forward. And fortunately, with the youthful exuberance of Bod, off he went flying around for the three tries. I think one thing that you always did, Brian, was you're and this is in training, and this is when we were playing matches, and certainly in that game, you're always in the right place at the right time. And when you've got a young fella, 19, 20 years of age, that's picking the ball off his toes and skinning Entomac, who basically didn't even lay a finger on you and knew that he was beaten from 15 yards away. I mean, that's the mark of the man. But it's that particular match, representative stuff, whatever, is certainly one of if not the my favourite match I've ever played in, just because of the occasion, the history, and the fact that Dricko scored a hat trick, and I was fortunate enough to have a ringside seat. So it was just it was a great game.
Am I right in saying it was your mum's 50th birthday? She was at the game.
Yeah, no, nearly. It was her 50th birthday, and I'd got a hotel flight, Eurostar. Couldn't afford to fly her. Eurostar and tickets to the match, and she had to pick the tickets up from a different hotel. And herself and my stepdad Jim, they couldn't find the other hotel, so they watched it in a bar around the corner.
No,
you're kidding.
So they didn't even get into the ground, right? And I didn't even know this until I'd spoken to actually the following morning at about 5:30 with Dricko walking down the Champs-Élysées. So that was as close as she got. So it was her 50th birthday, the lovely Liz, and she never quite got there, but I think she enjoyed the occasion all the same.
Tell us about the preceding 4 to 5 hours before the phone call at 5:30 in the morning.
Funny enough, finished the match and we got together, and I think it was one of the first times, Dricko, that they had mixed dinners and they'd allowed women in. We did that, and then we went down the Champs-Élysées, went to a lovely little nightclub. I wasn't with Brian at this stage, and had a few vodkas with Mixer, obviously, because drink in moderation. If you're listening, kids, don't do it. Just have the odd one every now and again, a couple of units a week. Left there, and I came back to the hotel about 1:30. And I was pretty full. I was pretty full, to be honest with you. And there was a revolving door in the hotel. And I've gone through the revolving door, only the once. And I was walking in, what do I do? And I look down, and there's a young bedraggled man in a monkey suit with a bit of drool coming out of his mouth, lying on a chaise longue in the lobby. And I thought, Christ, if that was me and I'd scored a hat-trick and Ireland had won for the first time in 28 years, I'd still be out. So I decided that it was up to me now to pick him up off the couch and to go back through the revolving door and back down the Champs-Élysées, which is exactly what we did.
The last thing Brian O'Driscoll wanted was to be dragged back out into the Champs-Élysées, but there you go.
Well, in fairness, necking bottles of red wine, eating omelettes and singing karaoke. I mean, he was like Lazarus. He made an unbelievable comeback.
until that fresh air hit me walking out of that whatever restaurant, bar, nightclub, whatever it was, I've felt better. But do you remember those words when I was heaving up my guts when you said to me, standing over, you said, oh my God, if the people of Ireland could see you now, 8 hours ago you were scoring 3 tries in Stade de France, now you're heaving up your omelette and chips on the Champs-Élysées. Oh, how the mighty have fallen.
But you see, that's the magic of the man, that you're in Paris, you've got someone honking like a goose, and even his sick somehow managed to turn into an art form. It's just, I don't know what it was. And it smelt of potpourri or something like that. It just wasn't normal.
And at that stage, you said, I better give Mum a ring.
Yes. Yeah, I thought that was the right time. I thought that was the right moment. So I gave her a call. She, at that time in the morning, took a few rings, obviously, to wake her up. She answered the phone. Rob, is everything okay? Everything okay? Everything? He said, yeah. I'm just such and such. I want you to have a word with Brian, because he really needed to speak to my mother at that time in the morning. So they were both quite cordial on the telephone. She gave me the phone back and she said, by the way, never effing ring me at that time in the morning again. So,
no doubt.
But no, it was good.
So serious point for a second. When you get the second phone call from Donald Lenihan and he says, you're going to be a British and Irish Lion. Tell us about that. That is the fruition of a lot of hard work, as you mentioned earlier on. That must be incredible. Try and describe what that meant. Were you expecting to get the call? Did you think you were in with a sniff?
Yeah, well, they'd obviously, when they're doing line selection, they start off with a big panel, then they condense it, then they condense it, and they condense it. And that year, I'd actually, because I'd got the personal trainer, etc., and was trying to up my game, I suppose, I personally fully expected to go. I really did. Yeah. And then obviously when the phone call comes through and it's Donald on the other end of the line and he says, Hendo, I just need to talk to you about selection. At that point, I just said, okay, get on with it. So pretty blasé about it, because I'd had the disappointment before, almost gearing myself up for the disappointment. Mm. And he said, I let you down a few years ago. I've got better news this time. You're in. Wow. So, and it was basically that simple. So, obviously put the phone down, let it sink in for a couple of seconds, then ran around the house like a lunatic. And, I think it was quite late actually. It was about 10:30 that he called me, and then nipped round to a friend's house for a couple of beers.
Magic.
You'd scored a hat trick against Italy that year though, right? So, you know, you were in great form and, I think, as much as it's a surprise when you hear your name, you know, called out or you get a phone call, I think there is, you know, there would have been 50 players with high expectations to be selected that would have been in the mix. I think there's very few players that come out of line selection going, God, I didn't think he was going to pick me. As rugby innately feel as though we should be backed. And that's why you managed to make it to international rugby, is because you, I suppose, ultimately you do back yourself. So,
yeah. Well, that year, as you say, I mean, I'd actually had a stint at fly half as well. So I was playing for Wasp at the time, and I think Alex King and Gareth Rees were both injured. So they threw me in to play 10. And I actually scored a hat-trick at 10 as well. in the Premiership against Gloucester that year. Total yardage, 6. So it was basically ruck on the line, send in the fat number 10, and that was it. But so I'd scored a hat-trick for club, scored a hat-trick for Ireland, obviously, the day after having met Papa, PJ2, Pope John Paul II, which was fantastic. That was it. Do you remember that when Ralla got kicked forward?
I wasn't. I didn't. I was injured for it.
No, but the story about Ralla getting kicked forward.
Yeah.
So the three people are allowed to meet the Pope. And Ralla, who's obviously, he deserves his own TV show. He might only get one story out, but the series would last forever. He didn't want, he was desperate, obviously, to meet the Pope. And Keith Wood, being the captain, and he said, no, Ralla, please, you do it. Ralla was being a bit hesitant. So Claw gave him a kick up the hole, and he stumbled forward and landed at the knees of Pope John Paul II. And all he could do was lift up his head and grab his ring, give him a kiss, just before he get dragged off by the Swiss guard. It was brilliant. but yeah, again, the call was amazing. Obviously, Drico's got had some previous with my roommate, actually, Austin Healy, on that tour. I don't know whether you want to expand on that.
Oh, it's been much discussed. I won't make him do that. Because I can't, I'm a bit too young to quite remember the build-up. So it's you, it's Brian, there's Will Greenwood, I think there's Mike Catt. Like, how early on did you know that it'd be you and Brian playing in centre? Like, not just British and Irish Lion tourists, but you're going to be starting the test matches. Was that a big dogfight, or were you in pole position going out there?
When did I know? I knew as soon as I'd finished injuring the other two. Because you take out the opposition, and then they're left with no choices. They have to pick you. I don't know. It was one of those things. Obviously, Catty was playing well, and so was Will. Obviously, Will having missed out in 97 with that terrible injury.
Yeah.
Because he should probably have played in that series anyway, and for him to get injured. I mean, the mark of Will as a player. After one of the test matches, I actually gave him my jersey. I said, listen, this is as much yours as it is mine. Because I think he was very, very unfortunate. Would it have been a toss of a coin? I'd like to think it would have been. We're both playing well on the tour. Scored a hat-trick on the tour as well in one of the games. So I was at the best I could be. Will was at the best he could be. Unfortunately, injury took that away from the that thing away from the selectors. But obviously, having played with Brian for the last couple of years, it was pretty seamless. And having obviously Johnny Wilkinson and Brian O'Driscoll, it's a dream for me to sit in that back line. So would I have been picked if they're all in? Of course I would. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Brian, how did you two operate as a centre partnership? Was there much talk beforehand, much talk on the pitch, good understanding? I know the game was very different then.
Yeah, I think there was a good understanding. I think we probably, you know, pretty clearly defined roles. You know, obviously, I think Hendo gave you great advantage line, but he had a good offloading game as well, which is probably, you know, underrated. You know, Ala, the second try in Paris, you know, that ability to hold it to the last second. So I think it's just a case of trying to run good lines and have him, you know, when you are running decoy lines, you got to be that viable option. And that's what holds defenders down on the inside. I think we had a good understanding. There wasn't always a huge need for communication because you get to know one another's body language quite clearly. I think Phil Larder, the English defensive coach who was with the Lions, was nervous about the two of us defending together for the first test, that we didn't maybe understand his system properly. And then I remember him coming up to us after the first test going, I was completely wrong. You know, I mightn't have had the faith, but I've never seen a defensive, you know, defensive display from centre pairing like that. So that was nice to hear, considering where that England team were coming from. So it was, yeah, I think we worked well off one another. There was a real comfort and a knowledge of how one another operated, and that on our day that we could cause issues, and defensively, I thought we were a pretty solid unit. So always good memories.
I think if you, I don't know whether you've got video of obviously waltzing O'Driscoll, flying through the line. But rugby is still all about inches. And if you go back to the ruck just beforehand.
Pump those legs, boy.
You'll see me lean onto the ruck and then think, shit, I'm being watched here, and then have to pump my legs, and it moves forward an inch. But as we all know, an inch is the difference between an ooh and an ah, and that gave you the space to go. So I'm claiming an assist on that one.
Oh, very good.
To sum up before we let you go, how did you enjoy trading the bright lights of London for Castle Connell?
Oh, Castle Connell was amazing. Absolutely amazing. And I regularly reminisce with my wife, Angie, about this. I mean, it was halcyon days. You're playing with, obviously going down and playing with Munster, one of the best teams in Europe, with your best mates. And to be honest with you, there was one other fella that when I went down there who was a young 18, 19-year-old. There's seminal moments in your career when you go onto a field, and be it training or wherever it is, you say, that guy there is absolute class. And obviously, with present company, you got that immediately with Brian. And when I joined Munster, the one fellow that stood out, and after the very first training session that we shared together for Munster, I turned around to him and said, you will captain the Lions one day, my friend. And that was Paul O'Connell. And when you're blessed enough in your career to play with one of the greatest backs that Ireland's ever produced and one of the greatest forwards, it makes it very, very simple. I think...
What did he have in that first session or at that age?
Oh, Jesus. He was fearless. He was fearless. He spoke. He wasn't shy or intimidated. He had great skills and speed. And he was everything a second row shouldn't be. He was kind of a back at 6'6", whatever he was. He was the complete article. And I think that it's a shame that injury curtailed his career at the back end, because I think he definitely had a few more years left in him. But just that sheer class. It's like with Dricker. Dricker always had time on the ball. He always never seemed to be going that quickly, but you could never catch him. I mean, when Munster playing Leinster many, many times, it was myself and John Kelly, predominantly all Mike Mullins, and it would be up against Darce and Dricko. So it was, can our forwards win enough ball? And if they can't, we've just got to get off the line and shut those guys down, because don't give them any space, because they just dance around you, which would have been the case. I mean, obviously, to dance around me, you'd need a feeding station on either hip, but we just had to shut them down. So Dricko was just, I don't know. I don't want to talk about him as a rugby player, because everyone talks about him as a rugby player, and you've got a million videos and DVDs and things you can hear about him. But first and foremost, as a man and as a young man, and for me, watching his career progress and that kind of ebbed and flowed as well, from a young guy that was fearless, that didn't have any issues with taking on 50, 60 cap internationals, to then going into the gym and bulking out a bit, then coming back down and working more on skills and adapting his game over his career, was just amazing. And I'm just delighted to have been a small part of that.
Well, listen, thanks so much for coming on. It's been great to hear from you. Great to reunite you two. You'll always have Paris.
Before we go, Joe, you know, I had to find out from one of the lads to see whether there's a backline play in the Ireland camp still called the Hendo. Do you know that? 20 years on.
Is there still?
Still, yeah.
I reckon it's either a miss one or a dummy scissors, because I had the best one in Europe.
it's just pocket 12. Give us a kick to the time.
Love up the fat lad.
The Lions used the Hendo as well in 2013. I think 2009, 2013. But I was impressed to hear that they're still going 20 years on. So you've probably left your mark.
Love it. There Love it. Go.
The Hendo. Listen, Rob, thanks so much. Brian, as ever, thanks a million.
Cheers. Good to chat, Hendo.
Monday Night Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us, everyone in.